How does a medical miracle become a for-profit nightmare? That's just what happened with the life-saving technology of kidney dialysis, according to author Tom Mueller. Tom's writing has appeared in The New Yorker, National Geographic, The New York Times Magazine, and The Atlantic. In his new book, How to Make a Killing, Blood, Death, and Dollars in American Medicine, he explains how greed has corrupted the dialysis system and what it tells us about the broader problems with American healthcare. Here's Tom to share key insights from his book.
I'm Tom Mueller, and I'd like to tell you a bit about my new book, How to Make a Killing. In the past, I've written about a range of things, including food fraud, whistleblowing, the evolution of whales, computer chess programming, and the vast ancient landscapes hidden beneath modern Rome. My latest book unites some of these disparate fields: science and technology, history, ethics, and investigative journalism. How to Make a Killing is a medical whodunit, which explores America's badly broken healthcare system through the lens of the kidney dialysis industry. This book bite will explore six key insights from my book. So let's launch in. Insight number one: kidneys are the unsung heroes of our body chemistry. 375 million years ago, when the first lobe-fin fishes hauled themselves up onto dry land, they carried a pool of primordial ocean within themselves, a puddle of the saltwatery world where their forebears had swum for eons. As these beasts morphed into the incredible wealth of terrestrial life we know today, geckos, platypuses, peregrine falcons, hippos, and eventually humans, all of their ancestors continued to carry that same ancestral ocean inside them, all thanks to the kidney, which maintains that precise chemical solution that our cells, blood, and tissues need to survive. The kidneys are the guardians of homeostasis, that delicate balance of salt water, electrolytes, and assorted other nutrients, which we all need to live. Some ancient civilizations sensed this near-mystical wizardry. The Egyptian Book of the Dead sings the kidneys' praises, and embalmers sometimes left the kidneys in place when they mummified their pharaohs, maybe thinking that these obscure organs played some vital role in the pharaonic afterlife. The Hebrews saw the kidneys as a source of profound intuitions and desires, as well as a repository of divine wisdom. "My kidneys give me counsel in the night," says the psalmist. Today, though, kidneys get no respect. We praise people for their heart or their brains, for their lungs or even their guts, but spare not a word for their renal fortitude. Yet without those fist-sized, bean-shaped organs flanking the base of our spine, all the other organs, even our mighty brain, would swiftly fail. Superficially, it might be said that the function of the kidneys is to make urine, wrote Homer Smith, a groundbreaking physiologist. But in a more considered view, one can say that kidneys make the stuff of philosophy itself. Insight number two: how a medical miracle became a healthcare nightmare. The fact is, your kidneys are essential to your survival. Until the 1960s, kidney failure was a death sentence without reprieve. Then, a series of medical innovators, engineers, and tinkerers devised the first dialysis machines, sometimes using sewing machine motors, ice cream makers, sausage casings, and parts from downed Luftwaffe fighter planes. Suddenly, people who had been condemned to death could live for years, even decades. Trouble was, limited dialysis centers meant that only a handful of the thousands of kidney failure patients could be treated. The rest died. One center instituted a so-called God panel to determine who would live and who would die. These heart-wrenching decisions helped trigger the birth of a new field, bioethics. Major news outlets picked up the story, and Congress began to see kidney failure as a threat to the American dream, and dialysis as the antidote. In 1972, Richard Nixon signed a law making dialysis the first ever Medicare for All medical condition. The U.S. government had agreed to pay for the dialysis treatment of nearly all of its citizens, which sounds like a triumph. Yet today, dialysis patients in the U.S. have on average the worst outcomes and spend more on treatment than in any other developed nation. What is going on? Insight number three: fast food is hard on the kidneys. Today in America, there's an epidemic of kidney disease driven by three underlying epidemics: diabetes, hypertension, and obesity. At the root of all this, of course, is fast food, with its unrelenting bombardment of salt, sugar, and fat. But fast food also describes a philosophy of healthcare, widely practiced in U.S. dialysis and in other medical fields. According to the fast food model, standardized assembly line medicine will provide the best care at the lowest cost. Fast food medicine grew out of the underlying premises of neoliberalism, which the U.S. has bought into since Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, that for-profit, free-market medicine yields optimal and optimally priced health outcomes. Sadly, these assumptions have proven disastrously wrong. In healthcare overall, the U.S. provides worse care at far higher cost than any other developed nation. We now spend about 18% of our GDP on healthcare, and our medical outcomes have dropped to the bottom of the OECD list by most measures. The United States currently ranks 29th among OECD nations in life expectancy, for example, and 33rd in infant mortality. The assumptions behind fast food medicine have also proven dead wrong in U.S. dialysis. About a quarter of U.S. patients die every year, compared to 9 to 12% in Western Europe and only 5 to 6% in Japan. Back in 2009, two senior nephrologists, Raymond Hakim, former chief medical officer of Fresenius, the dialysis giant, and Robert Foley, published a paper in a respected medical journal. Its title was, "Why is the mortality of dialysis patients in the United States much higher than the rest of the world?" Pretty straightforward message, right? Some foreign nephrologists are even less diplomatic. Distinguished Australian nephrologist John Agar recently said to me, "For many years now, I've been telling my American colleagues, you have to stop killing your patients." Insight number four, the limits of free market medicine. We thought we were going to find, quite frankly, that the big dialysis chains offered better care at a lower cost, says economist Ryan McDevitt at Duke, who has researched the industry for over a decade. Actually, we found the opposite. The big chains chase the dollar no matter what. They favor quantity over quality. The trouble is, in healthcare, the patient outcomes depend so much on the quality of care you get. Death rates go up, hospitalization rates go up, transplant rates fall, and so on. Any measure that could get worse pretty much got worse after the big chains acquired independent facilities. McDevitt and fellow economists at Penn State, Brigham Young, the Federal Trade Commission, and elsewhere have identified a phenomenon in American dialysis they call stealth consolidation. Big firms gobbling up little ones under the radar of the Federal Trade Commission, which has produced the current duopoly of Fresenius and DaVita, who control some 80% of the dialysis market in America. They also highlight another key economic principle, incentives and how profit motive can mold human behavior. We're talking about what is euphemistically known as cherry picking and lemon dropping. And here I should say that the major dialysis companies strenuously disagree with my analysis and deny that they ever cherry pick or lemon drop. Anyway, cherry picking goes like this. Privately insured dialysis patients are vastly more profitable than Medicare or Medicaid patients, sometimes 10 times more profitable, sometimes even more. So private payer patients get the red carpet treatment, the best treatment times, the most attentive service, and so on. If a privately insured patient and a Medicare patient are competing for a dialysis station, it's easy to imagine who often gets the nod. This is called cherry picking, selecting and pampering higher margin patients who make you more money. Lemon dropping is the opposite phenomenon. Some dialysis patients, typically low-value Medicare patients or patients who complain about the quality of their care, or particularly ill patients who might lower the healthcare ratings of a dialysis facility, may be involuntarily discharged or lemon dropped. Again, dialysis companies deny that they do this, but my reporting suggests otherwise and also indicates that certain discharge patients are often blackballed by other facilities in their area, even those run by competitors. Their only remaining option to get dialysis is the emergency room, which, as one senior nephrologist told me, is a death sentence of 6 to 12 months. Cherry-picking and lemon-dropping have been reported in other areas of healthcare, including nursing homes and hospitals. An economist might predict that such behaviors are almost inevitable in aggressively for-profit medicine, where caregiver behavior, conscious or unconscious, can be shaped by economic incentives. Insight number five, Musketeers and Real Americans. One of the more striking scenes in my book is a skit performed at the corporate retreat of a dialysis leader, DaVita, during which senior executives dressed as musketeers pretend to sword fight and kill three black-masked villains who threaten their firm's profits. These villains are a government healthcare official, an insurance executive, and a federal prosecutor. Though clearly meant as a joke, might this skit provide insights into the organizational culture of the firm involved? In real life, many major dialysis firms have faced charges of illegal kickbacks, Medicare fraud, patient harm, violations of the Foreign Practices Act, and on, and have signed enormous legal settlements to resolve these allegations while carefully denying liability. Some dialysis leaders galvanize their troops by borrowing organizational methods from religion, sports, and the military. Some observers have compared this behavior to a cult. Daniel Barbier, a dialysis nurse who escaped totalitarianism in Romania when he fled to the U.S. in 1982, was horrified by his company leaders performing on stage. "I said to myself, oh my God, I ran away from communism, and here it is again. I won't sell my soul for these people. I would rather dig ditches." These are the voices who really ring out in my book. Patients and caregivers caught in a tough, tough place, who nevertheless speak out with courage, clarity, and poignancy that I think you'll find hard to forget or to ignore. Magellan Hanford, former LAPD officer who retrained as a dialysis nurse when he became a single father. "I have to move fast from one patient to another. No time to ask them how they feel, how their family is. Just, okay, you're still breathing, and move on. My job is nursing people, but I can't do my job on this assembly line." Sherry Thompson lays her hand on the arm of her husband, Gerald Thompson, a dialysis patient, and says, "It's got to stop. We're going to do what we can to make that happen. That's our goal. We don't want anybody to feel this way. We don't want anybody to go through the abuse." Insight number 6, we can do better. Dialysis is the canary in the coal mine for American healthcare overall. In 1972, when Congress made kidney failure the first Medicare for All disease, Republicans and Democrats, and most Americans at large, assumed covering dialysis was the first step towards comprehensive national health. In fact, starting around this time, many developed nations began making comprehensive health care a birthright of their citizens. But America took a very different road. Watergate and Vietnam destroyed the bipartisan momentum towards national health. Then the economic crisis of the OPEC oil embargo and runaway stagflation refocused the national attention not on building enduring government programs like universal health care, but on cutting costs and on handing more and more of our public goods, including our medicine, to for-profit firms. We need to take a hard look at where that road we started down in 1972 has taken us, to healthcare that is poor yet ruinously expensive and out of the reach of many Americans. We need to fix dialysis and treat some of our most vulnerable patients with the respect they deserve, but dialysis again needs to become the bellwether. We also need to realign our healthcare system overall with the fundamental tenets of the Hippocratic Oath and human compassion. The challenges we face in fixing dialysis and American healthcare overall are daunting. But take heart, or gird your kidneys. Countless other countries point the way to better care. And here at home, in America, things have gotten so bad that a bipartisan consensus like we had in 1972 may again be possible. I hope you enjoy the book and that it provides rich and nutritious food for thought. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. That was Big Ideas from How to Make a Killing: Blood, Death, and Dollars in American Medicine by Tom Mueller. You might also like our book bite for Random Acts of Medicine by Anupam Jena and Christopher Worsham. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.